liked you. Who in the hell ever said, I got to like you? What law is there to say, I got to like you? I go out of here every morning and bust my butt putting up them crackers all day long because I like you. You is the biggest fool I ever saw.
This is Minnesota Play, bitch.
Bitch.
I'm Mandy.
I'm Mo.
And this is episode 7. Today, tonight, and right now, cut that part out, we're going to talk about some of the shit we saw, but through other people's words.
Because we don't want to talk about it.
Listen, because
we don't feel like it.
Well, because we went and we were both like, oh, yeah, this is exactly what I thought it was going to be, which is, like, not good. So, like, what's the point of having another episode where we're like, we saw stuff we didn't like, and I have to hear about it?
We gotta change it up.
We need to prove to you, through the words of other reviewers, who agree that it also wasn't a good show.
We need white authority to validate our black and brown voices.
Ew. Are we doing that?
Bitch, it's a joke. Don't worry about Mandy tonight. Mandy's baby.
I'm baby today. I'm baby. Okay, so the Minnesota Opera.
Yes.
Did an opera, part of their new works initiative. So a brand new commissioned piece called The Fix, which was about 8 baseball players who conspired with gamblers to fix the World Series in 1919. The Chicago White Sox. Okay? So they... I'm sorry, could you please wake up? I'm trying to sing you a story. Imagine if you went to O Fortuna and it was all men screaming.
O Fortuna.
Ba, ba, ta, na. Oh, sorry.
Were there any women in the show?
Okay, so there's one woman, right? Okay, so here's how the story goes.
Yeah.
There is the two main characters of this story, like the tragic heroes, if you will, of The Fix, which is Shoeless Joe Jackson and his...
He ain't got no shoes.
He ain't got no shoes because, listen, he's a farmer or some shit. He's, like, from the country, but he's, like, so good at baseball that they bring him to Chicago to play because he's, like, really good. Baseball back in the 1919s was, like, a way to get, like, money and famous right away, kind of like being a rock star now. Anyways, Shoeless Joe Jackson and his wife, Katie, are, like, the tragic heroes. And he gets recruited to this baseball league called the White Sox. And then they're like, hey, like, these gamblers are gonna, like, pay us money if we, like, purposely lose the World Series. And Joe Jackson goes along with the gamble or the lie, not because he's a criminal, but because he doesn't want to let his team down.
Okay.
They get caught, they get put on trial. It's found not guilty, but they're also, like, banned from doing baseball forever. And that's, like, so tragic, right? Well, here's what the...
Sorry. I really didn't want to go. Like, he tried to invite me a couple times, and I was just like... It just isn't sounding like my bag.
It really isn't anyone's bag.
But, okay, so...
So, the Wall Street Journal talks about The Fix. An opera strikes out. And
get it? Because baseball.
They talk about Katie, Joe's wife, who is a lone significant female voice because she's the only soprano / woman in the show, is victimized but fails to arouse our sympathies. Because, like, basically, she has these couple songs with Joe about he's, like, such a kind heart and he can't let people take advantage of him and that she loves him, whatever, whatever. And then the gangsters are like, listen, if you, like, tell anybody that you're gambling with us, we'll, like, kill your wife. And, like, literally nobody cared because it was...
But also, how are you gonna make the only woman in the show be the center of, like, she... Her whole job is to garner as much sympathy as possible. Like, you can't put that much pressure on one character, one woman.
Do you want to know what race she was?
Bitch.
Bitch, she was black, too.
God damn it!
So shout out Jasmine, you're so cool.
Like, let's just do some better journalism. That's all I'm saying. Wait, just to interrogate that a little bit, a little. You got the only black woman in the play.
But you know what? Let's focus on
the men.
Let's focus on what matters here. The Fix falls back on sentimental tropes about baseball and sports heroes with feet of clay. Even more problematically, it's nearly 24 male characters, baseball players, owners, gamblers, and sports writers. For the most part, neither emerge as musically distinct individuals nor a ensemble.
Damn.
Which is, like, pretty accurate of what I saw.
That's real rough. That's rough.
It was too bad. And it just, like, brings the question of, like, if you have this new works initiative, like, what's the point of doing these kinds of stories? Like, who are we doing these stories for?
Yeah.
And, like, why?
And who's benefiting?
And who's benefiting from telling these stories? Clearly, Heidi Wilson from Wall Street Journal was not benefiting from this story. And neither was I.
I'm going to go ahead and guess that the entire history of opera thus far probably is not very feminist.
I guess.
So, like, is, like, when you do new works, are you correcting, making a correction for history? Like, what's new about doing a play with 24 men and one woman? From, like,
yeah,
business as usual, yeah, to me.
The best part is trying to market these shows, because of course we don't pick the new works.
You don't get to be a part of the process where you ask some questions.
Where I say, what's going on here? Instead, we get to make ads that say things like, an opera of major league proportions.
Because it's baseball.
The baseball's biggest scandal ever. And it's like, damn, we were setting people up for some epic ass shit. But instead, one might expect an operatic baseball team to have choral moments, but other than a brief pedestrian ensemble in a locker room that involved blowing bubbles, dreaming dreams, and scheming schemes, there were none. There was a song.
Heidi was mad.
Well, and, like, there was a song about them blowing bubbles and scheming schemes. And
wait, what? That was a song?
That was a song. She's
Heidi
making fun of
just
a song.
Make that up?
No!
I thought that was funny.
She's dragging their ass.
That was clever.
It was...
But it was in the music.
She was insulting the libretto.
Wow.
I know.
Oof. Oof. I'm going to give this review 4 stars. Totally hitting the elements that are problematic. Being really honest about what wasn't working. Totally missed the mark on the... on the equity dynamics.
Yeah, and one of the things that... either was not important to the Wall Street Journal, or, like, maybe wasn't noticed for whatever reason. Like, maybe she was asleep, or, like, too angry, or, like, hungry, or whatever. Like, for whatever, this part was also not written about, which is that it was, like, colorblind casted. So, like, it was written about this baseball team in 1919, and so, yeah, they were all white men, and, like, but they also had, like, baseball nicknames that were also, like, directed at their, like, ethnicity or their skin color. So, like, they had nicknames like Swede and Cracker, but, like, the people who were playing Swede and Cracker were, like, people of color. And I just want to know if anyone noticed. If you notice, DM me at MN Play Binchtagram. Also, Twitter's dead.
Oh, yeah. There's no more Minnesota Play Bish 1. We killed it.
We weren't using it.
We can't keep up with three. Are we even keeping up with our Facebook, really?
Look, not
Insta's
really.
Insta's really the future.
Yeah. I just have a full-time job, and I put all of my hours towards Instagram and nothing else.
If you know a grant that we could get to do Minnesota Play Bish full-time, DM us. Don't tweet us. DM us at Minnesota Play Binchtagram.
Or visit us on mnplaybish.com. We got a website.
Check out our SoundCloud.
SoundCloud. We're on Spotify.
Yeah,
we're on Spotify.
Wow.
I don't know if we're on iTunes, but like I asked if we could be on iTunes. We're like anywhere you get your podcasts.
Your podcasts. Listen to us at work.
Yeah. Also talk about us to everyone, you know. Oh, I will tell you this one thing about The Fix. I was watching it, and during intermission, I turned around, and there was, like, some writer who was there for Lavender or something. Mm-hmm. And he was talking to me, and he was like, oh, because I told him I worked here or whatever.
Yeah.
He was like, oh, the man up there who is singing for one of the baseball players, he was the main person in Italian Straw Hat. And I just, like, think that their characters are so different. And, like, in this one, he's just, like, playing a totally different person. And I'm just, like, so surprised. And I'm like, oh, that's great. Like, I'm glad you got to see both shows or, like, whatever, whatever.
Yeah.
And then there was, like, a meet and greet with the artist or something afterwards that I helped with.
Yeah.
And so I was there and I was talking to somebody else who worked there and I was like, oh my god, this reviewer was like, saw these two different shows with the same actor and he was like so great and like whatever, whatever. And like, I just wanted to say like, he was so amazing. And they were like, wait, what? And I was like, I don't know. I don't know. The actor who like was in Italian Straw Hat and is also in The Fix. And they were like, are you talking about Woo Woo? And I was like, I think so. And they were like, oh, that's not the same person as who was in Italian Straw Hat. And I was like,
oh no,
it wasn't me who thought that. It was the reviewer from wherever he was from. And it was really embarrassing.
That's heavy.
That's why I'm
busy. That is a blind spot that you have to work on. We all like, got them.
Like, knowing who's doing the shows that I'm marketing.
But, yeah. Yeah. And not mixing up.
I didn't mix them up.
The people of color.
I was just saying thank you to the guy.
But you couldn't correct it.
Cut this whole episode out.
So I, without you, I saw Cyrano.
Yeah.
Which, as far as I can tell, is about a white man who gets friend zoned.
Because he's ugly.
Because he thinks he's ugly.
Keyword, he thinks he's ugly. If you love yourself, everyone's gonna love you back.
Except some people won't.
Yeah.
But you'll be okay with it.
Right. Because you love yourself.
Because you love yourself. But then, you know, then it's fine. He just, like, stays friends with this woman. And it's fine.
Wait, but doesn't he die?
And then he dies at the end.
It sounds like an opera.
Twas. It was as long as one.
Oh, no. How long was it?
Three, two.
No.
Almost three.
Oh, no. That's 2:45. So long.
It felt long. I just want to do a quick rundown of the terrible puns that people used to describe this play. Because it is a show with a lot of swords and men's fighting. Another show with so many men and basically one main woman whose entire arc of the play is the growth of her love
Wow.
for Cyrano.
Okay.
and her other lover, whose name is Christian, or Christian.
Uh-huh.
It's French.
We ain't French.
Christian.
Christian. Dom Perignon.
So here it is. The best puns.
The best Cyrano puns.
From the Pioneer Press, Cyrano's wit and rapier are sharp.
Wait, his what?
It's a type of sword.
Oh.
It sounds like rape, but it's... Cyrano brandishes wit with the same deadly accuracy as a rapier. I didn't know that you needed two comments about that sword. I think you did it in the one, but here we are.
Is it like the really like skinny looking one with the little...
The pointy...
Yeah. I'm sword woke. Yeah.
Sword woke. The plot is universally striking, says the Oracle.
Universally striking.
What does that mean?
That means anyone in the universe can watch it and it would just, they would be like, hashtag relate. Cyrano was also one of those that you asked me a couple times to go with you and I was like, I don't think I can. I just don't think I can.
The nose of Cyrano de Bergerac is famously overlong. And so, too, is his final scene. Star Tribune.
His nose is long and so is his final death scene. Okay, but if you had, like, Cyrano's nose, would you feel ugly? Don't answer that.
I mean, I don't know what the history of this play is, but many... people in plays in the Western theater who have large noses are either villains or Jewish caricatures or both.
Mm.
So it's always complicated to put a person with a large nose on stage and then call them ugly.
Yeah.
And I think that's something like Andrew's adaptation that he really tried to reckon with in making him, like, lovable.
Okay.
That he's, like, beloved by his army people.
Homies.
His homies.
Yeah.
Roxanne, uh-huh. as, like, familially as his cousin. Like, he's crazy and, like, gets into all of these fights with people. And is cocky, but he is loved. So that it becomes like an inner thing, but it's still, you know, it's just... It's never going to like really sit right because of the history of that caricature. The one thing that many reviews did agree on, besides how entertaining the flashing swords were... were that Jan Chambers, who is the costume director, her costume design was sumptuous.
Yeah, I did see some pics, and I was like, oh, that's very rich.
The first time I saw Jenny Greenberry in the hallway in costume, I gasped. Because she looked so...
like a snack.
Elegant, and like a whole snack. And I was like, okay, I know her. Everyone's in love with her. And, like, the first scene where Joel Lissman comes out as, like, the actor that Cyrano hates. He's in this gigantic, just gorgeous, ridiculous thing. So I agree with the reviewers there. It was very opulent, luscious, delicious, glittering, stunning, painterly, lavish, divine.
So it's like...
panache.
So it's like all the words that white people give to their interior designers when they're remodeling their kitchen. This is what I want it to look like. I just don't believe it. I have trust issues. I don't think that it was that good. Like, it couldn't have been.
My experience of it was, visually the best of what the Guthrie does.
You okay, know, good.
You see the money.
Yeah, it was Joe's show. Couldn't be anything less than that.
The parts that were difficult, yes, it was quite long. I will agree reluctantly with Chris Hewitt from the Star Tribune. The death scene, it felt like half an hour. But I think it was 20 minutes.
Well, didn't you say they were, like, homies were, like, hovering over him, but, like, 10 feet away?
Yeah, and then, like I talked about with West Side Story, there's this feeling of, like, an individual who is fighting against some force.
Yeah.
In West Side Story, it was, like, the American dream, as shown by, like, the Statue of Liberty. And Cyrano, it's, like, he's having these, like, I don't know what to call them, visions?
He's, like, walking to the light, like...
Yeah.
Life is flashing.
Yeah, something is happening.
Some, like, dead shit.
At this point, we're at minute 17 of this, of the part where you know he's dying. And then the stage goes dark, and the people that have loved him the most his entire life, his best friends, Roxanne, are in the, like, darkness as the lights, like come down around him, and you focus on him, and he's saying all these, like, poetic, beautiful things. And all I could keep thinking was, like, why don't they hold him? He's dying. And they only get to hold him when he, like, collapses and is dead.
Oh.
And then, even then, the men don't embrace him.
Yeah.
They, like, kind of hold his, like, catch him when he falls.
Yeah.
And then lay him into Roxanne's lap and arms. And so she is the last person holding him.
They're like, oh, shit, he's fallen over. No homo, though. Goodbye, my dearest friend.
And I
die knowing that I never thought you were sexy whatsoever.
And I'm just like, make that shit gay.
Yeah,
like,
make it gay. Like cry for your
man. We're
that
man friend love. Like,
yeah.
That, and don't need to be sexual.
Yeah.
For them to, like, love each other.
Yeah. To be intimate.
Yeah, to have some intimacy. I would love to cut out some of it in order to add more, like, real intimacy.
Yeah. Which is exactly what you do for this podcast, is you just chop it up.
I just chop all that dumb shit out.
Imagine what you can do on the stage.
Y'all, it takes me hours to edit these eps. Hours well spent. Hours well spent.
Tell me about your friend. Did they do the show Oklahoma?
Okay.
Or they just posted the review for Oklahoma?
So, this show neither of us have seen. But we want to review this review. Because it's so wild.
Okay, so...
Where are they doing Oklahoma? Where is it?
I can tell you in a second, but I think it's important to know about The Observer, who reviewed it. The media outlet. The Observer offers a sophisticated readership of metropolitan professionals.
White.
An original take on the latest news, culture, politics, and luxury, bringing this irreverent sensibility to a national audience. Which is completely opposite of what we're trying to do. But anyways.
We're trying to have a niche audience of black and brown and queer and hella gay. Wait, did I say that right?
Kind
folks.
Of, yeah. Okay, so Rex Reed.
Wait, first, my friend.
Yes. Right?
So someone posted this on my friend Victor Vasquez's wall on Facebook. He is the casting director at Arena Stage.
Mm-hmm.
And was like, I'll save you the trouble of reading this by just posting the title of this review, which is Broadway's latest Oklahoma revival is a gimmicky travesty with cornbread.
Perfect. Sign me up.
So here was Victor's review of this review. I'd ask what's up Rex Reed's ass, but I'm afraid his secret penchant for being fisted has caused his queer and loose ass to completely swallow a straight, white, bitter old man in some body snatcher shit as he is clearly screaming out for attention. Pass. So shout out to Victor for introducing us to Rex Reed and his review.
Oh, no!
Of Oklahoma. We are looking at a photo of Rex Reed.
Rex Reed, one of the most renowned film critics in American history.
Wait, he's a film critic?
I guess so. Has been reviewing movies for The Observer for nearly the entirety of the paper's existence.
That must be right. We'll get into the review, but it brings up a lot of references about the film Oklahoma.
Yeah, it does. That makes sense. So before coming to The Observer, Reed wrote for Vogue, Q, The New York Times, The Daily News, New York Post. He's the author of 8 books, including bestseller Do You Sleep in the Nude? And his profile of the aging Ava Gardner, who cares? anyways, he was mad. I kind of just want to do, an entire dramatic reading of the whole article.
Yeah, so this production is it's on Broadway right now, right?
It is.
In case you want to look up anything about it that Rex hasn't written.
It's at New York's Circle in the Square Theater.
And so they've done a kind of untraditional, I guess, take. We haven't read anything about... We don't know anything about the production besides what's in this review. untraditional take on Oklahoma. A kind of pared down and, diverse casting.
Right.
That's what's important to know. And now... Rex Reed's Observer review.
A dramatic reading.
It had to happen. The miserable fools who are hell-bent on changing...
Blow my ears out.
We gotta turn down the gain.
Don't hold it up to your mouth. Just right here.
It had to happen. The miserable fools who are hell-bent on changing the theater world by destroying timeless classics in a misguided effort to make them relevant, trendy, and politically correct, whatever that means, finally got around to screwing up Oklahoma.
I'm so angry about everything that first, if he was like, how can I make every millennial mad? How do you destroy a classic? First of all. Also, that any effort to make theater relevant is misguided.
Yeah.
For reasons that make no sense whatsoever,
he's like British now.
Yeah.
The landmark 1943 Rodgers and Hammerstein production that marked the beginning of a new era in American musicals has now been cheapened and vulgarized at New York Circle in the Square Theater in a quote-unquote modernized version designed to appeal to kids who have never heard of Oklahoma. And me. And ignorant ticket buyers who hate musicals in general and avoid anything categorized as old-fashioned in particular.
Okay.
Boo-hoo! I went to a show that forced a perspective that isn't my own onto me.
Literally, who is ignorant enough to go to Oklahoma not knowing that it's a musical? Nobody. Everyone knows what Oklahoma is, and that shit sucks anyways.
Yeah, if you didn't know, why would you go? I wouldn't.
Literally, the people who are gonna go see this
on Broadway.
This Oklahoma on Broadway are going to be the same people that go to all the shows on Broadway.
Yeah.
And so the lights go up on the farm owned by Lori Williams and her beloved no-nonsense aunt, Eller, both immortalized by golden voices. As he talks about the film.
So much.
To reveal a set consisting of 8 tables replete with feastware. You can buy it.
Feastware.
What's that?
It's like this style of, like, dishware that's kind of iconic.
You could buy at Bloomingdale's, and 16 crock pots you can order online.
Where do we get all of our crock pots?
And chairs from IKEA that took the production staff 8 hours after tech to build.
We added that part, that's not.
For the next 2 hours and 45 minutes, everything that can go wrong in a lunk-headed, misguided musical actually manages to do so.
Okay, but like 5 stars for using the word lunk-headed. Lori is now black.
That's the first thing he mentions. She didn't use
everything that manages to go wrong in this lunk-headed musical, and then the first thing that he says, Lori is black. Now black.
Ruined it. Completely ruined it for
Wait,
me.
Wait, which is perfectly acceptable. Great. Thanks. If only Rebecca Naomi Jones were a better singer. So it's not acceptable for Lori to be black when she's a bad singer. Because if you're just going to hire a bad black woman, you might as well hire a good white woman.
Well,
there can only be one Charlotte Greenwood. He's name-dropping people like I care. But the ubiquitous Mary Testa, who has screamed her way through scores of shows, to my astonishment, is the most charmless Aunt Eller it has ever been my displeasure to see. Parenthetical, even worse to hear.
I think he had a lot of fun, right?
Yeah, he did.
I've seen dozens of Curlies in my day, including Gordon McRae, but greatest was Hugh Jackman. Sorry that Broadway couldn't get Hugh Jackman to play your Curly. Damon
Sorry, Damon.
Sorry, Damon, but your Curly is not for the history books. Half rock and roll, half hillbilly country western. But he does grow on you when he's given half a chance to sing a ballad slowly and melodically without yodeling, which he does on the sweet second chorus of The Surly with the Fringe on Top.
Oversexed audience pleaser. Wait. Addo Annie, parenthetical, physically handicapped, Ally Stroker. First we're using...
Oh, Ally Stroker.
A word that the disability community has, like, firmly said, do not use this word to describe us. God. Like...
Please don't call me that.
Do not use this word. And then it's like... I'll keep going. You'll see. Now belts out, I'm just a girl who can't say no in a wheelchair as a nod to disabled performers everywhere.
Wait, what? I don't understand. Can you break that down for me? What is he trying to get at? Because I don't get it.
That it's kind of like, oh, like, you're just a part of this, like, Edie and I. Like, you're a token.
Yeah.
You got hired because you're in a wheelchair, not because you're a talented person who deserved to be cast.
Rex!
But, like, why even...
Was that the whole paragraph?
No, I don't even want to read the rest of it because it's so egregious.
Read the intermission part of it. It's the crux of this article.
Wait, this part. Instead of the historic Agnes DeMille Dream Ballet that distinguished the original 1943 Oklahoma and remains an integral part of every revival, we now get a half-naked girl with a shaved head prancing from one of this stage to another, imitating a horse while a cowboy boots drop from the ceiling with noisy, clumsy thuds.
Okay, that does sound like...
Maybe that was really the sound of Oscar Hammerstein and Richard Rodgers thrashing around in shock from their graves.
That's not the intermittent. This guy is like us, but like not cute.
But like not cute.
During intermission, the audience is served chili and cornbread.
Which sounds great. Thank you for addressing the issue. Of not having food or dinner before going to see a show. I would have loved that.
I would have loved that, too. The Roger and Hammerstein's organization should be ashamed for giving permission to produce this gimmicky travesty. Its namesakes were catapulted to an internal prominence by Oklahoma, and they didn't need cornbread. Back in my day, Oklahoma was just good because it was. Now you need cornbread.
Now you need cornbread.
Bald, shaved head ladies. Wheelchairs.
Black people.
And black. Color girls.
Okay. That's, 5 stars to the attitude.
That's the funniest show I've ever.
I'm here for, like, just being... so angry at a show, like, you've seen.
100% like roasted Oklahoma.
On the other hand, it's so egregious in the way that it talks about the actors. And
like, I don't know anyone who talks like this in real life.
No one. For me, it's like, you didn't do this alone. Like, who was your editor? Like,
right. Who let this through?
Who let you use this word that has been... There are many, like, complicated conversations that happen around communities and what they want to be named. But, like, I feel like universally every community's got one word where they're like, this word is not the one.
Like, that ain't it. That please don't use. Wow. But, you know, I think the reason that it gets a 5 for how, like for the audacity of the caucasity is that, like, I feel like all the reviewers out here in Minneapolis, like, review biasly based on how much money the institution is giving them in advertisements. And nobody, and everyone's scared to say it's bad, except sometimes Chris Hewitt is like, that was a little too long, you know? But, like... We got people from, like, the Wall Street Journal coming out of the woodwork, like, what the fuck are you doing? We have, but then we have all these reviewers from the Twin Cities, like, such a great night with the swords and dancing.
And just, like, not really, what always gets me is, like, not a sense of, like, a deep interpretation of, like, the context. Like, another thing that I like about this horribly, like, egregious review is that, like, at least he's placing it in some kind... Like, here's what I know this to be. And he's talking about different productions and, like, the movie and talking about actors. Like, it's taking place in history. And, like, I don't think that he goes deep enough into what that production was trying to do, but there is a sense of, like, this was trying to appeal to a certain audience, and I wasn't that person, and I hate it, so I hated it.
Yeah,
but
it
when
was
you
terrible.
Read reviews here, there's no sense that this production is happening in time,
right?
Space,
yeah,
history, like everything just sounds like. Jan Chambers' costumes were pretty. Okay, what were Jan Chambers' costumes trying to do? Like, what does Jan Chambers do? Like, why is this aesthetic important for telling this story about Cyrano?
Right.
Is it just because we have the money to produce it at that level of aesthetic? Or, like, is it telling us something about the relationships of the people in this play? You know, I just want more journalism. Like, how does this compare to other productions you've seen? How does it compare to what's happening in our city right now? Like, what does it mean to have one woman on stage in a show about men? Like, now. Just like it.
Yeah.
You know, just name some things.
Yeah. You're noticing it.
And it, why don't you name what it? Is it trying to do? And, like, does it achieve that?
Right.
Like, I don't think I ever read any reviews that are, like, telling me what the show is trying to do.
Right.
Or say. And then, like, judging it against that. It's usually, like, I liked this. And I'm like, I don't think it was her what you like.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what if I might like it.
Yeah.
Because I like tons of shit that people don't like.
Yeah. Mostly I like stuff people don't like. Oh, anyways, don't go to school to be an actor in the Twin Cities. Go to school to be a journalist.
It's a dying profession.
For a dying art.
For a dying art. But you only need one. I guess it's us for now. You.
You're welcome. So fuck that shit. Here's the good shit.
What's the good shit?
All of the atrocious things that are happening in the world.
Oh,
today.
Great.
Let's talk about the Hungarian singers that were allegedly forced to sign papers to state that they identified as African American in an all-white Porgy and Bess.
I'm gonna be honest, you said this to me, I didn't make it past the headline because it was so ridiculous.
The Hungarian website Index reported that before the April 5th performance, singers were asked to sign papers that read, "I, the undersigned, hereby state that African American origin and identity are inseparable parts of my identity. Because of this, I'm especially glad to be able to perform in George Gershwin's opera, Porgy and Bess." But for why, though? Like, sign this paper and say you are this. Like, are they going to shut it down? Like, what are they going to do? I don't understand.
I don't understand why every person who had that paper in front of them didn't get up and walk out.
They were like, oh, fuck. It's like... It's like when Ariel signs her life away.
Yeah,
legs.
She's like closing her eyes. Like, hope this doesn't come back to bite me.
So there's all I gotta say about that. Another thing that happened was the Philadelphia Theater Company was like, hey, we are totally redoing our whole shit. We have a commitment to highlight stories that speak to a racially diverse Philadelphia community. Then they selected three playwrights for their upcoming 1920 season, and they're all white. One of them, which is The Wolves.
Which we love.
Which we love.
But, like...
We just stared at each other and blinked because we just... So what happens is... Some actors and playwrights local to Philadelphia write this open letter that basically calls them out. And I just want to say, shout out to y'all.
Shout out to y'all.
Elena DeMonaco. And my homie... What's his name? Hagen Bryce Walker.
And, like, a bunch of other people signed that letter, too, from the Philly community, right?
Yes.
And they all kind of, like, talked about
their
identities.
When they signed the letter, they included what their identities were. So they had somebody who was a white cis Philadelphia-based performer and teaching artist. They had somebody who was a Philadelphia-based queer white cis gendered able-bodied female. Like, they just, like, went in on their identities. You have a Latinx Jewish, non-binary, trans, self-producing playwright, a Black, Latina, queer actor playwright.
Yeah, it's just really nice, like, to see that there are white people there who were calling it out, as well as the people who whose identities were most marginalized from this season. And then I felt like they interviewed the artistic director. It's mm-hmm. her second season programming.
Uh-huh.
And one of the reasons she gave of why the programming turned out all three plays, three white directors, was because of finances. And here we are again after Jordan Peele's Us has literally blown the box office records out of the water. Hearing another person say that people of color, stories about people of color are not
making money.
Making money. They're not financially, what am I trying to say?
I don't know.
They're not, I don't know.
Cut that part out. It's another example of how these, like, white leaders are trying to create this, what am I trying to say? Retire. Here's a quote from Paige Price, who is the artistic director of Philadelphia Theater Company. "Our audience is not as diverse as our cities, I thought. We have to put more shows where people in Philly can see themselves, whether they're queer audiences or African-American audiences, because there's no other audiences." We've done the Terrace McNally plays for so long that we have a niche for the older generation, and I would like to find a new generation. It's another example of how these new artistic directors are trying to, like, create their legacy around diversifying their work and, like, changing the, like, trajectory of theater and, like, the audience and, like, just, like, developing this new community that doesn't exist because, oh, we, like, only serve this old white generation that's dying. So let's get the new generation, which just happens to be darker and queerer, into the audience. But then we're not going to represent you after we made, like, one really good season. We're just going to, like, continue to do all of these white shows.
Yeah. And, I mean, it's not just white leaders either, because as I was telling you about... Jamil Jude at True Colors Theater in Atlanta, which my parents have a subscription to because I bought it. like, he just programmed, he's the new artistic director there, and he just programmed a season called She Griots about black characters and black playwrights. And the first two shows of the season, one play by Dominique Morisseau, the second play is Ghoul Girls by Jocelyn Bio. But then, like, the third play, which I have worked on before, is called Marie and Rosetta by George Brandt. And the way it's listed in the season announcement, like, you can almost forget to think about the identity of the playwrights, because what's been told to you is, like, this is a season that's celebrating black playwrights and black characters. Mm-hmm. But George Brandt, not just black playwrights and black characters, but women.
Yeah.
George Brandt is a white man.
Right.
And, like, I understand, like, putting Maria and Rosetta in that season.
Right.
But you had three plays. You couldn't pick one?
Yeah.
That was by a black woman about black women.
There has to be something.
I'm going
to
go ahead and name you. I made a little list. I looked at the history of the True Colors Theater to make sure they hadn't produced any of these plays before. I've got five plays that could have gone in that slot.
Tell me.
Blacks by Aziz Barnes. Or is it Aziza Barnes? Sorry. It was just done in D.C. It looked really fun. I think it's an ensemble of black women.
Okay.
My favorite, Lynn Nottage, has intimate apparel. ruined. Yeah. I mean, really, she's got so many in her repertoire about black women. And she's the only woman to have won two Pulitzers for her playwriting. So what a better time to celebrate Lynn Nottage. Venus by Susan Laurie Parks.
Oh, I love Susan Laurie Parks.
She just had Father Comes Home from the Wars, parts 1, 2, and 3 on Broadway. That play isn't particularly about women, but Venus is about women's bodies, mm-hmm. black women's bodies. Mm-hmm. And Alicia Harris, who just had What to Send Up When It Goes Down, published in American Theater Magazine. So she's trying to get someone to produce that.
Right.
And that has been available since 2016, I think, that script. And it was just done off Broadway in the past year. So, you know, just a few. I could go on.
It's hard to not, like, want to die. With all this shit going on, like...
It's just like...
How hard is it?
Is it... Again, Marie and Rosetta, I understand it. Especially in Atlanta, it's gonna do well. It's a play about music. With a lot of, like, church standards, gospel singing. They're probably gonna hire some, like, local powerhouses and just blow it out of the water. But the script is, like, as the dramaturg on the play at Park Square Theater, there are parts in the script where he conflates two historical people who have the same name.
Yeah.
And that's just one thing out of many things that are a little bit irritating. Like, it's a little messy in addition to being done by a white man about two black women in history.
Listen, there's only one way to solve this problem, and that's to burn it down. So I just want to shout out to the teenagers who are charged with setting the Shakespeare Theater in Connecticut on fire. What started out as a rich brown color gradually turned into a silvery gray over years of exposure to elements.
That is my favorite part of that.
Basically, it's a theater in Connecticut. It was, like, really great in, like, the 80s or some shit. And, like, there were a lot of famous people that came through there. And then, like, it just kind of died. People stopped going. They weren't using it. They were about to renovate it.
But they were holding on to the... They said they were about to renovate it, but they've been holding on to it for something like 10 years.
Yeah.
And it was empty.
Yeah. And it started out rich and brown and then turned into a silvery gray color over years of exposure to the elements, which is
hashtag me.
All of us. All of us brown people in Minnesota over the winter. Working in the theater industry, we're just turning silvery gray like all of our.
And then two teens committed arson.
I don't think they ever said a motive in this article, but
they didn't. But, like, what a metaphor. I'm not saying that we should all go out and burn down some buildings, but should we metaphorically burn down some shit?
Absolutely.
Yeah.